that sense of the that the human engine waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting, with nowhere to go. No passenger, empty. I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour, the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time, clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the window, perilously spread, her drying combinations touched by the sun's last rays, on the divan are piled, at night her bed. Stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I, too, awaited the expected guest. He, the young man carbuncular, arrives. A small house agent's clerk, with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat upon a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended, she is bored and tired. Endeavors to engage her in caresses, which are unreproved if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once, exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response, and makes a welcome of indifference. Nigh, Tiresias, have for suffered all, enacted on this same divan or bed, I who have sat by Thebes below the wall, and walked among the lowest of the dead, bestows one final patronizing kiss, and turns, and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns, and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done with, and I'm glad it's over. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. This is the picture of love in the wasteland. Now, I don't know how much you want to connect to that kind of thing, but without getting into confessional things, our vanity requires no response. It's not new to any of us, I don't think. Our vanity requires no response. And I think there is one of the leaping lines of the poem. Eliot is known as a guy who can write a phrase that is going to stick in your mind, you're never going to forget it. And he doesn't just do it once. But in this section of the poem, he does it line after line after line. It was one of the things that angered the critics when it came out, because you're not supposed to talk about something like this. If you're going to have a seduction, it should be at least a good one. But good heavens, to talk about a seduction, it reminds me of the line in Zhivago, to call this rape would flatter both of us. Remember that line? Mm-hmm. To call this rape would flatter both of us. Now here's a man and a woman, but who was there? Was anyone there? Was there any touching? Indifference, no response. The irony of this whole thing is very rich. He, the young man carbuncular, that means the pimply young man, he, the young man pimply, arrives. A small house agent's clerk, with one bold stare. I know that. I was about 4:15. Had one bold stare. One of the low on whom assurance sits is a silk hat upon a Bradford millionaire. Bradford or the new rich. On whom assurance sits, a cocky way we used to walk into bars down in Kansas. You know, try that in Minnesota and you get beat up. You know, in Kansas, everybody does it, and it's no big deal. But it's the one bold stare. You walk in a bar. I even forget how to do it, but you know, you kind of cock your head, and one shoulder's down, and then you can twitch your shoulders a little bit. But there's the one of the lines. One of the low on whom assurance sits is a silk hat upon a Bradford millionaire. Sophomores in college. I'm sorry, you guys were all soft. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. I mean, it's a good time. The meal is ended. She is bored and tired. Now, a good time to seduce somebody, she's bored and tired. That's rotten time. Endeavors to engage her in caresses which are unreproved, if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response. She's not there. Reminds me of Lewis's statement that the man who says he wants a woman doesn't want, that's exactly what he doesn't want. He wants a pleasure for which a woman happens to be a necessary piece of apparatus. It's a good line from Lewis. That's what you're seeing here. His vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. Would rather have indifference. It's much easier that way. Doesn't get complicated that way. You know that consenting adult relationships. In a sense, it's a welcome of indifference. Let's keep it that way, and then it's not going to get complicated. Nitresius has suffered all. He says that, and then he bestows one final patronizing kiss. I can just see this young, bold fellow sort of, you know, doing a Clark Gable and leaning over and giving her a kiss, and then comically groping his way and stumbling out the hall down the darkened stairs, finding his way unlit. Now, the note on that is from Goldsmith. He parodies Goldsmith from The Vicar of Wakefield, a song in The Vicar of Wakefield, where a woman has been seduced and responds to that seduction in this way. When lovely woman stoops to folly and finds too late that men betray, what charm can soothe her melancholy? What art can wash her guilt away? The only art her guilt to cover, to hide her shame from every eye, to give repentance to her lover and wring his bosom, is to die. And that was the response in the Vicar of Wakefield song. And what's her response? She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done with, and I'm glad it's over. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. The ironic contrast, again, between a gracious, at least a meaningful, at least a intense past, and a graceless, dead, automatic, engine kind of life present is what's happening here. Now the scene changes out of that room. You're going down by the river where you've got old fish market on one side of the Thames, and on the other side you've got the great, fantastic Wren cathedrals and so forth. And it's an interesting sort of contrast just there. There's the old bars and fisher thing, and then there's the big cathedrals on the other side. This music crept by me upon the waters and along the strand up Queen Victoria Street. O city, city, I can sometimes hear, besides a public bar in Lower Thames Street, the pleasant whining of a mandolin and a clatter and a chatter from within, where fishermen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr hold inexplicable splendor of Ionian white and gold. Next to this, the river sweats oil and tar. The barges drift with the turning tide, red sails wide to leeward, swing on the heavy spar. The barges wash drifting logs down Greenwich Reach past the Isle of Dogs. Elizabeth and Leicester beating oars, the stern was formed a gilded shell, red and gold, the brisk swell rippling both shores, southwest wind carried downstream, the peal of bells, white towers. We've got a contrast of Queen Elizabeth's time and the present time. The oil sweats, the river sweats oil and tar. And Elizabeth and Leicester beating oars, the stern was formed a gilded shell, red and gold, and so forth. Then back to the present time, trams and dusty trees. Highbury bore me, Richard and Kew undid me. By Richmond I raised my knees supine upon the floor of a narrow canoe. My feet are at Murrigate and my heart under my feet. After the event, here's another seduction. Canoe body has been used as a body, image of the body. Canoe is talked about in terms of a coffin, too, for a kind of a final voyage. I've never made this connection before, but I've got a line in, you know, many of us choose to live in narrow furnished graves, narrow well-furnished graves. But I raise my knees supine upon the floor of a narrow canoe. My feet are at Moorgate and my heart under my feet. After the event, he wept. He promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent? He wept. There's some promise there that somebody is living in a world where there can be such a thing as guilt and potentially then grace. And she says, he wept. He promised a new start. I made no comment. What should I resent? And I wish I had the... There's some pages in Samler's Planet by Saul Bellow about what happens when one starts to think about themselves in such a way that they... Well, who am I to resent anything? And who am I to really resent anything that somebody does to me? I mean, when you lose your self-respect, it starts to... You start to just sort of... It doesn't really matter anymore. The person, the lady speaking here, what should I resent? It doesn't even, there's no loss. On Margate Sands, I can connect nothing with nothing. All you have is a heap of broken images. On Margate Sands, I can connect nothing with nothing. The broken fingernails, dirty hands, my people, humble people who expect nothing. Tragedy of man is that he expects too little. Remember Bev saying that tonight? You know, the tragedy of man that who expects too little. Kierkegaard's, we have a castle and we live in a doghouse. We have a castle and we live in a doghouse. La la, to Carthage then I came. St. Augustine speaks. To Carthage then I came, burning, 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 burning. O Lord, thou pluckest me out. O Lord, thou pluckest, burning. And to know, well, what was it? The fire sermon is over. What did we have? Now, death by water, it's a funny patch, part of the poem. It's the most lyrical part. I'll read it. It's beautiful sounding things. Just a few things before I read it, I think that, well, let me read it first. Phlebas the Phoenician, a fortnight dead, forgot the cry of gulls in the deep sea swell and the profit and loss. A current under the sea picked his bones in whispers as he rose and fell. He passed the stages of his youth, age and youth, entering the whirlpool. Gentile or Jew, O you who turn the wheel and look to windward, consider Phlebas, who was once as handsome and tall as you. The sounds of that are just beautiful, and there's a lyrical rhythm to it, and so forth. What's happening? The Phoenician is dead. Fear death by drowning. He's dead. The thing that got him to move over the sea was that was profit and loss. The sea is life. The prime mover of our life is what? Profit and loss nowadays. It no longer, our life is not moved by a free giving. It's moved by trade. A current under the sea picked his bones in whispers. He's past all, there is no afterlife. He's dead, dead, you know, dead. As he rose and fell, his only rising again is this, the current, just, you know, you ever, well, I don't know, seen anything dead fish on the beach, you know, that's the image. That's what our life looks like, is what the guy's saying. He rose and fell, he passed the stages of his age and youth, what, in ascendancy? Passed the ages of his youth, instead of saying his youth and age, but the stages of his age and youth entering the whirlpool. The life goes where? Down the drain. Entering the whirlpool. Sucked under. Gentile or Jew? Now in the New Testament, St. Paul, he says, in the kingdom of heaven, there's not either Jew nor Greek, male or female. The rhetoric starts to burn. St. Paul sort of rhetoric comes in here. Gentile or Jew? Everybody. No exceptions, everybody. Oh, you who turn to wheel and look to windward. There's that dawn, there's that possibility thing again. Consider Phlebas, who was once as handsome and tall as you. It's a nonsense. Oh, you who are the captain of your life, who turn the wheel and look into the spirit, you know, look to windward, look in, you know, consider Phoebus, who's once as handsome and tall as you. That's it, dead. No hope. Stetson. Death is no resurrection. Man goes down the drain. What the thunder said. Now, in this passage, you get a nightmare that... It's a nightmare that starts at the Garden of Gethsemane and goes through the Garden of Gethsemane, down the road to Emmaus, and to India, and Buddhism, and Hinduism, and Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. But it starts in Gethsemane, goes down the road to Emmaus, and then ends up the other place. After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains, he who was living is now dead. We who were living are now dying with a little patience. There's the noticeable lack. Gethsemane has happened. The crucifixion has happened. The palace, the prison and the palace, and the death at 9 o'clock in which the thunder... The thunder and the earth quaked. He who was living is now dead. We who were living, went while we had faith in him, are now dying with a little patience. Is this poem written during the 3 days that Christ was in the tomb, in hell? We who are living are now dying with a little patience. That's another one of those tremendous phrases. We who are living are now dying with a little patience. And what's left then? With that gone. With him gone. There is no water but only rock. Rock and no water and the sandy road, the road winding among the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink. Amongst the rock, one cannot stop or think. Sweat is dry and feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rock, dead mountain mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Here one can neither stand, nor lie, nor sit. Here is not even silence in the mountain, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but dry, sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. If there were water and no rock, if there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock, if there were the sound of water only, not the cicada, the dry grass singing, but sound of water over rock where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 drop. But there is no water. Who is the third who walks always beside you on the road to Emmaus? When I count, there are only you and I together, but when I look up ahead of the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman, or the gardener. But who is that on the other side of you? What is that sound high in the air? Murmur of maternal lamentation, the daughters of Rachel will not be comforted. Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth ringed by the flat horizon only? What is the city over the mountains, heaven? Cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air, falling towers, all the cultures. Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. Nightmare intensifies. Everything is inverted here. The woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings, and bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward down a blackened wall, and upside down in air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours, and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and all the prophets. Voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. In this decayed hole among the mountains, in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing. over the tumbled graves about the chapel, there is the empty chapel, only the wind's home. There was a pilgrimage, the Fisher King, the story, the footnote, read in the red book, the note at the beginning of the poem, on that there's a Fisher King who has an injury, and it is in his sexual organs, and because of that, there's a wasteland. I mean, everything is waste, nothing grows, and he can only be saved and life brought back to the land if a pure knight makes a pilgrimage to the Chapel Perilous and goes through all sorts of dangers, and then gets there and asks the right questions and answers the right questions about the Grail. There's a mixing of Fisher King and Grail legend and all this. And so this pilgrimage, this has happened. We already found out that the guy is not the pure knight, Percival. But he comes finally to the end where hopefully something can happen. So there can be some hope, where the questions can be answered that can free the land from being a wasteland. There's the empty chapel, only the wind's home. It has no windows, and the door swings. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the roof tree. Cocorico, cocorico. The cock can signal two things, really. I think the signal of new morning or the signal of betrayal, Peter. And do we have betrayals here? In the flash of lightning, then a damp gust bringing rain, the Ganges River in India was sunken, and the limp leaves waited for rain while the black clouds gathered far distant over the Himalayas. The possibility of rain, the jungle crouched, humped in silence. Then spoke the thunder. Da! It emphasizes that you've got to put something in. Two. This. And then the first word of the fable, I'll read the footnote on this, because some of you don't have the red book. Data dayadvam damyata, give, sympathize, control. The fable of the meaning of the thunder is found in the Upanishad. In the fable of the thunder, the Lord of creation thunders three times, the thunder being represented by the sound da. His pupils interpret the meaning in three different ways, according to three different Sanskrit words beginning with da and three that Eliot uses in the poem. The fable then closes with the instruction, the same thing does the divine voice hear, thunder repeat, da, da, da. That is, restrain yourselves, give, be compassionate. Okay. Thunder speaks. It's like a question. He answers. Da, data, what have we given? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender which an age of prudence can never retract. By this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries or in memories draped by the beneficent spider or under seals broken by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. Have we given? What was the answer? We have not existed. Existence meant the awful daring of a moment's surrender, which an age of prudence can never retract. We feared, and we did not give of ourself. Had we done that, we would have existed. We didn't exist. This life, this existence, is not to be found in our obituaries, or memories draped by the beneficent spider, or under seals broken by the guy who opens up our will. In our empty rooms, we're dead. Da, dayadvam. Dayadvam is the, which one is that? Sympathize. Okay, in order to sympathize with something, I mean it, okay, in some senses, in order to have passion, or to be compassionate, you have to have passion, and you have to get out of yourself to sympathize, to be compassionate with somebody else, to get out of yourself. Do you sympathize? Have we sympathized? The answer, I have heard the key turn in the door once, and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison. Thinking of the key, each confirms a prison. We lock ourselves in. Were we locked in? Can we sympathize if we can't come out? The only time that we could ever, the only way we ever did come out was only at nightfall. Ethereal rumors revived for a moment a broken Coriolanus. Your mouth goes open like that, and then usually something comes out. Muttering retreat? No, I was thinking of Proof Rock 2 in another way. Coriolanus had pride, you know, pride killing him. And only in our dreams do we revive at all. And he chose more life in his dreams. His retreats. I think it does connect there, Don, in terms of the retreats. That was the liveliest thing about him. Yeah, I think it does. Of restless nights, yeah. In one night cheap hotels. Well, control. Damyata. The boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. Did we control, or would we much rather be controlled? My heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. It's the theme of the grand, one of the themes of the Grand Inquisitor. Give it up. Be controlled rather than to control. Was it mourning? Was it betrayal? You will betray me three times before the cock crows. Are these three betrayals? I sat upon the shore fishing with the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order, rather than Dante, who said, shall I, O Lord, help, I pray thee, help me set my loves in order. And this guy, at this point in the poem, from this powerful poem moving, he starts to come like, it's sort of like a homily. But it isn't as good as, O Lord, help me set my loves in order. It's, shall I at least set my lands in order? Sounds more like Ben Franklin than Dante. Now you get in this poem, you get the broken images. You have a handful of broken images. Nothing, and it connects with nothing. And these images are coming so fast, and these quotations are coming so fast. My image is always a guy who's cracked up. He's been trying to understand the meaning of life, and he's cracking up, and he's in a library, and he's running down through the stacks, just pulling books out from the, you know, here, and just hits the wall. Okay, that's my image for what happens in this thing. In some ways, this is something that's happening through the whole poem. It's just the pace of this poem speeds now to an almost impossible rate, and if I wish I could speak these languages so that I could fluently and quickly, you know, read them as fast as they're written. I can't. I'll stumble. But I sat upon the shore, fishing with the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? Answer to the question, are you capable? London Bridge is falling down. One line from one thing, another line from another thing, another line from another thing. These fragments I've shored against my ruins. Why then, I'll fit you. Hieronymo's mad again. Data, Dayadvam. Tamyata. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Ambiguity. Is this poem hopeful. It ends with a blessing. It's not hopeful. The blessing isn't a language I don't understand. The benediction. Something interesting. We can talk about this if this is of interest. Where did these quotes come from and what significance are there? I would like to stress before my bladder bursts, and then I'll come back and we can ask some questions. But in Kidd's Spanish Tragedy, where these last lines come from, "Why then, I'll fit you," Hieronymo's mad again. Hieronymo suffers fits of madness through grief for his murdered son. He writes a play by means of which he hopes to kill the murderers who are to be persuaded to act in it along with himself. When an invitation comes from the court that will allow him to carry out his plan, he accepts eagerly, saying to the murderers who have brought the invitation, "While then, I'll fit you, I'll supply you." And the second half of Eliot's line is the subtitle. Whose son died in this poem? The poet is father to the poem, and the son of a culture, and God playing a joke.
Could you maybe talk a little bit about the shadows that he mentions?
Where?
The Old Testament prophet.
Oh, right at first? Well,
yeah.
God is likened to the, you know, he will hide you under his wing. You come in out into the coolness of the shadow of God, the rock. I don't know where this is. Does it say here? Is it in a psalm?
I will hide thee under the shadow of my wings.
Yeah. But there's a rock too. I went through, when I was reading the prophets, I came across that. But it's as a positive thing.
Lead me to the rock that is higher than I.
Well, they actually talk about it in terms of you come in under the shadow, you know, of this rock. I will shelter you like a tree shelters, you know, you can hide in this, the room for many to roost in my branches, hide in the shelter. The dead tree gives no shelter. I don't know the cricket, no relief. I don't know there. The dry stone, no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this rock. This is the promising line. You know, it's hot, dry. You know, you're on the desert, in the wasteland, and shadow, the coolness of the shadow is something good.
There's a verse that just he hired my soul in the cleft of the rock or something.
Okay.
You heard
something like that. Where's that from?
I don't know, it's from an old, it's from a gospel hymn.
From a hymn?
No, it's okay. From Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. And probably taken.
Must have been much more.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a story from the Old Testament. Someone, the Spirit of the Lord passed by and you can't look upon that, or it will kill you. And so God set the person in the cleft in the rock.
Oh. Huh. But come in under the shadow, this is the hopeful thing. Only there is shadow, and there's no water, but there is shadow. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding to meet you, your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. The hope shattered again, just wet. See? Does that answer that question?
Yeah. It seems to me you mentioned something about it on tape, and I guess I was kind of confused. You said something about between like conception and creativity, and you were trying to
read. Oh, I was using, that was using another way. It's from another poem of his. It's from The Hollow Men. That's using it in a different way. Did I link that with this? Or did I just want to use this as an excuse to talk about something that's really neat?
In the tape.
Okay. Well, in The Hollow Men, it's between the conception, the idea, conception and the reality comes the shadow. Here it is. It's at the end of The Hollow Men, which originally was was part of the material presented to, part of the material presented to Pound for his editing of The Wasteland, and it was published later, but it was originally part of The Wasteland. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow, for thine is the kingdom. Between the conception and the creation, between the emotion and the response, falls the shadow. Life is very long. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, between the essence and the essence and the descent, falls the shadow. For thine is the kingdom. For thine is, life is. For thine is, the. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. I think you can link it with that passage in that in the shadow, rather than the cool, is the fear. And between the conception and creation, the emotion and the response, the idea and the reality, the motion and the act, falls the shadow, fear, that makes you unable to say, to continue, for thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory forever and ever, amen. But it, between the conception, the desire to do that, then the fear comes in, locking you up. You can't trust. Can I trust? Is it so? Am I crazy? And you, all you can say is, for thine is, life is, for thine is the. But you can't finish it. See? And then when that happens, it's the end. Fear wins. And remember what Alice continued to say, you know, beautifully. Hate isn't the opposite of love. Fear is. See? Hate isn't the opposite of love. Fear is the opposite of love. And that when that fear wins, then this is the way the world ends. It's over. It doesn't even end with a bang, a passionate bang. It ends with a whimper. Our voices just trail off and we quit.
I just thought of another connection.
Yeah.
Could be, the death of the rock is dust.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, because at the very end he says, you know, here, I'll show you here, I can't see the dust.
That's a really good image. I'm having trouble connecting it here. I mean, with what Eliot is trying to do, but it is an awfully good image. That there is a certain erosion, you know. The sea of faith is withdrawn. The rock has crumbled. The rock of my salvation, you know. Oh Lord, my rock and my salvation, and all that's left is dust. Then, and the, yeah, fear, when that happens. When the faith goes, then you're left with the empty taxi, you know, thing, and you're also left with fear. Yeah.
Part way through this, he had a nervous breakdown.
Huh?
While he was writing this, he had a nervous
breakdown?
Was it finished?
Well, he gave it to Pound. Ezra Pound was an older guy, very big name, poet, critic, supporter of poetry. And Eliot gave him the rough draft, or gave him what he thought was the completed poem to Eliot, I mean to Pound. And Pound edited it and cut massive, you know, cut and edited an awful lot out. Took a lot out and ordered it like this. And then said, now you turn this is your poem. and Elliot went along with what Pound said. And he says it...
He dedicates it.
Yeah, he dedicates it to... Where does it say?
Before the very beginning of the poem, before Barry was dead, before Ezra Pound.
Yeah, it isn't in mine, but he says it is dedicated to Ezra Pound, the better maker. Mm-hmm. The better maker. And that, I think part of his own...
Emilio Pablo.
Yeah. And Pound took a lot of stuff out. Didn't put anything in, but it was essentially a reduction process. Cut big chunks of it out.
But like, how much of the city write while he was...
Well, I think it was the whole time that he wrote all this stuff, and I'm just guessing, because I don't have the specific stuff. I know that he did, and I know that he was by the waters of Laman, the sanitarium and so forth, and it was related at this time of the life that he wrote this, at the time of the life leading up to that point and at that point. He was probably working on this some at the time.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
well, as he was recuperating, while as he went into it, it probably helped him, you know, I mean, helped crack him up and helped him recover at the same time, probably. Mm-hmm. Because he does have this sense of, you know, there's a kind of, there's death, there's not resurrection, but there is. You say, what kind of hope is there in a poem like this? But the guy wrote it. That's hopeful. See? You take something like this, a little bleak and hopeless and everything, you could say, oh, yuck, why spend time looking at ugly stuff like that? The guy wrote it. You know? Yeah. He managed to write it. He's taken something that's, you know, he's taking something that could have been by itself only pathetic and made comedy possible. You know, that we can rise from this level, accept this death, and go from there. And I think Eliot himself did that. You know. But this is something that you got to be, you know, I mean, in responding to Eliot, you've got that problem because it's going to look so ugly, and you say, well, why look at it? You know, it's just, where's the hope? And you can try to put hope into it. And the most hopeful thing about it is the fact that it's written. The immense health that it took to be able to write this. See? Do I have enough health to allow myself out of my prison to risk cracking up, seeing the world, seeing this part of it, this part of the world, this part of myself? I mean, do I dare? There's that question again. Do I dare see myself as an old Adam? You know? Do I dare do as St. Paul and know that, you know? The chiefest of sinners, you know? Do I dare do that? And you said you do it, if a guy is at that point, like this sort of confession. You say, oh, that guy is sick. Wait a minute, who's sick? You know? He's confessed something, his own death. And he hasn't talked about resurrection. He wasn't a Christian at the time he wrote this. But the thing that strikes me as a reader, as a critic, is the shape. I mean, he just read it, you know? Because the notice of the lack is so specific and so noticeable, and it's just a matter of time until, you know, it fits, and he starts writing the Four Quartets, which is this tremendous Christian poem. But it's starting to happen because the lack, he knows what's missing. He who was living is now dead. And I can't yet believe. Because between the idea and the reality, between the conception and the, you know, act, all that falls the shadow yet. But he's got the idea. And it just hasn't come in. There's something looking into the heart of light, the silence. That image to me, have I mentioned the lifestyle people, the image of the Northern Lights? Okay, once I was in Minneapolis, over in St. Paul, and we walked outside, we were at a friend's house, and we just walked outside in the summer night, and looked up, and just mouth full open. We were in one of the conical, I guess would be the way to say, Northern Lights. They're not up flat across the sky, they're around you.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah.
Okay, have you ever seen them? They're green. Very different shades of green. It's underwater greens. And it's like it's you're in the middle of a cone of light. And the light, you know, you're in darkness. And then all around you, at about, you're right at the center, at the bottom. And you can move and walk and everything, and you're right in the center. And the way it looks to, I'm sure, anyone within, you know, the guy can be 10 miles away, and he'll look in the center, too. And there's this light, and it all points up, and it's moving and vibrant, and you're in the darkness, and it's so light, and it's moving green and very watery, and it's all pointing, and right at the tip of the cone is a blackness that is so black, because all the light points. And then there's that space, and that's faith. To me, all the light points, and then we hope against hope, not because we see him coming, as St. Paul says. Wouldn't be hope if we saw him coming. But God is there or God isn't there, and it's like that dot. It takes, you have to put something into it, you know, and say, I believe that. And we, you know, Christ is who he said he was. He is. But it is, it's there. The proof, the scientific proof is not going to be there. There's this plaque, and we can believe it or not. And I think at this point, at the time that Eliot wrote this, he looked into the heart of, you know, the heart of light, you know, right up to there. Silence. You know, and he said, at this time in his life, he didn't have the faith to know that the fact that he saw that you know, that place where all the light in the world points, you know, he felt that he didn't have something that other people have, maybe. But I don't think, you know, I think that's the way it looks to us. Maybe I'm all wet on that. That's John Grauber talking. I'm not going to say it as if I'm just the Holy Spirit talking, but to me, that's the way it is.
I can kind of look at it as like he's looking to the heart of light, the silence.
Yeah.
It can be like, you know, he's looking right for God and where he's supposed to be, the silence or something.
Yeah. And a man of faith looks into the heart of light, and
there's supposed to be something there, and he can't find it.
And what is it? The Word. Not the silence, but the Word. Made flesh. Dwelt among us. Pitched his tent among us. And he lives in the tent of our praise. This light thing is even good there, too. See? So...
And he made a resurrection.
Huh?
Elliot made a resurrection.
Yeah, in his own. Yeah.
His own.
Yeah. But the resurrection happened. But that the death had to happen too. And there's something too, I've mentioned the lifestyle, that I think that the measure, you know, you say, oh, this poor neurotic guy. You don't do that with him if you're tempted to do that, because you can never feel the loss and speak of the loss of meaning and the loss of love and the loss of joy without the same magnitude of the presence of meaning, the presence of joy, the presence of life. It just goes hand in hand.